You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks, just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest of our podcast this week is Joshua Summers, CEO at Enfi.
Culture itself is an organism. It lives, it breathes, and it is impacted positively or negatively by every single thing around it. You can't design a culture. You can't say, here's what our company will feel like, not look like, but feel like as an employee. It's impossible. But you can feed a culture with all the good things that hopefully help it to evolve like an organism into something that is a great place to work.
This is Joshua. We dig into how we turned a 72-hour banking crisis into a discovery process that reveals what lenders actually struggle with. You'll hear how Enfi operates like a 150-person company with just 14 people, and why the best insights come from when you're not trying to sell anything. The conversation reveals what happens when you fail completely, pick yourself up, and keep building, and why that moment of breakthrough changes everything. Well, hi, Joshua. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Ton.
It's a great pleasure. I've been reading into your history and like serial entrepreneur in a number of ways. Also, you got your track record in the capital raising arena. I've seen. Before we start talking about like your latest venture, Enfi, a little bit about you. What energizes you? What drives you as an entrepreneur?
You know, that's you went straight to like one of the most challenging but interesting questions. Look, I came out of school, and I don't believe you go to college to learn things other than really critical thinking. And so I came out of school with a degree in critical thinking is kind of how I look at it. And then the question is, how do you apply that? What do you do with that? And I started off in consulting, which really puts that to the test. Because you have to kind of change your ability to understand problems and rationalize them and come up with interesting solutions and do those in a very, you know, customer focused way. But then you leave the problem behind, you move on to the next project. And that created a challenge for me personally, because I never got to see what happened. And so I would say what drives me, it's being able to see what I build go into the world. And then being able to understand how that impacts people, how that impacts jobs, how that impacts industries, and watching that impact and being able to continue to iterate on that, that's what drives me, being able to build something meaningful.
I can totally understand that part, yeah. And getting the day-to-day feedback because people keep using it, exactly. Yeah, you've
hopefully.
Been through a couple of hopefully, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, making the jump then to your latest startup. I saw that was founded or established in November 23, and I read a lot around it that it had to do with the bank collapsing, and we all remember that point in time. But bring me the story. Like, what was that moment where you thought, hey, this has potential and something is broken that we need to fix?
Well, as a serial entrepreneur, I've been very fortunate. And some of those fortunes have led me to the ability to reinvest back into the startup ecosystem. And in doing so, I helped to co-found an angel investment group called TBD Angels that is very active in early stage angel investing. and has grown to about 300 investors and probably now about 90 different startups we've invested in. And in that process, I spend a lot of time with those startups. I spend a lot of time also with companies I sit on the board of and other friends who are entrepreneurs. And it led to a crisis moment when Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic had their challenges. And that crisis manifested itself in all of those that were in the industry scrambled to help different startups move their cash. Really, you struggle so hard to raise capital as a startup. It's such an incredible thing when you get that over the line and the deposit shows up in your bank account. And then to realize that the institution where you put your trust in literally took the one thing that you don't gamble with and put that at risk. That was a moment, a crisis moment. And so we called in every favor we could to help move the cash. And honestly, it wasn't a good moment for people, right? You don't want to participate in a bank run. You don't want to be the cause of the problem. But in a bank run, you also don't want to be the last one standing who didn't move your cash. And so we did everything we could. But in doing so, we ran into certain companies, certain startups where we couldn't move their capital. And it all came down to one reason, which is they held debt at either SVB or First Republic, and that debt had a covenant that restricted where their deposit could be held. That means there was a legal requirement that they maintain their deposit, their cash at those institutions. And if you attempt to move it, that stops the process and your money is locked down, and they actually can call the loan. And so you don't want to go through that process. You don't want to violate a covenant. And so ultimately, the problem was solved. The federal government stepped in, dust settled. But then what all good entrepreneurs do is they see something and they say, what did I learn from this? And so I think like this is that critical thinking thing is I stepped back. And not just myself, but I stepped back with a couple friends who we had co-invested. We went through that 72-hour craziness together, Scott Weller, Michelle Hipwood, and I, and we said, what did we learn? And that started what we call the journey of discovery. The best time to ask experts about what they do is when you're not asking them to buy anything from you. And so we went out and we talked to every person in lending we could. We talked to the CEOs and the chief credit officers and the chief risk officers of massive financial institutions and very small community banks and community lenders. We talked to private credit. We talked to credit unions. We talked to banks. We talked to fintech lenders. And we just wanted to learn. And what we learned is it's not about the deposits. It's not about the covenants. It's about the risk. And that risk is the challenge. Because there's just not enough people in the world to assess the risk and monitor the risk. And so they got to put covenants in place to really serve as guardrails. And we said, okay, there's an interesting challenge. How do you scale human capacity to understand risk? And that is what led us to decide to start N5.
Wow, what a story. I like it.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it represents so well chapter or trait number 7 in my book, Remarkable Software Companies Focus on the Essence. And this is such a good example of that, where everybody thinks it's this. And because you also apply curiosity and have this critical thinking and ability to step back, then you figure out that it's not about this, it's about something completely different. This is the root cause of the
I think
problems.
you nail it with focus on the essence. It's and I haven't always done that. This is like what four-time founders can say that they learn, which is I would say I got lucky with finding some essence early on, but this time you're right. We decided to really go deep and ask and learn before we had any hypothesis about starting a company or what it should do.
It's defining what is the real problem here. And so
That's
many
right.
people think that it's the symptoms, but at the end, if you're able to step back, then you can find and you get more, well, it's like you connect more dots, what's really going on, then you can find that essence and that root cause of the problem that needs to be solved. So
That's
then
right.
you decided, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to fix it. It's 23. It's November, so that's a good 1.5 year ago. There's all these technologies out there. What was what has been a fundamental decision back then that appear to be essential for where you are today?
So a lot of my career is built around timing and luck, and riding a wave. I was very fortunate to ride a wave with a company in the shift to mobile, for instance. And we launched one of the first, location-based advertising platforms on mobile and scaled it to profitable, and we sold it to PayPal. And we sold it in 2011, but we were at the early part of that wave, and that's just an incredible time to jump in on something. Well, we're at a wave now that's bigger than any wave that anybody has ever seen. And that's the concept and adoption of AI. AI first in both the way you build companies, but also in the product and the solutions you're building. And really the move towards agentic, architectures. And so, at the core, the essence that we discovered was not that risk was hard to monitor or track. The essence actually was that humans have capacity problems. And that human capacity constraint is what we're trying to solve. It's not a better way of understanding and tracking risk. Sure, we're creating that. But the difference maker is that the essence is human capacity, and we're creating agentic platforms that solve for that. They allow you to scale and complete whole jobs end to end agentically. So you no longer need to hire more humans to sell more loans, right? Banks, private credit lenders, they want to grow. The growth is through more loans. But the only way you can do that today is by hiring more humans. There aren't enough of them. They're not
True.
trained enough. They don't stick around long enough. That's the essence, human capacity and agentic solutions. That's what we're applying to that.
I mean, I read a couple of things, and one thing that's got me thinking about Steve Jobs and how he, back in the days, presented what is it? Was the iPhone? No, it was the iPod. 10,000 songs in your pocket, and I saw this connection with that. You got the power of 10,000 analysts sitting by your side, which is exactly what it is at the end. And it's so memorable, and now it's become something that you can comprehend.
It's funny because I didn't even think of the Steve Jobs, first of all, marketing genius, right? 10,000 songs in your pocket, it's such a great thing. And that's kind of the story of how he could envision like really taking a product to market. I never made that connection, but you're right. Like it's visceral to think of it that way. It's like imagine how well you can do your job if there's 10,000, credit analysts sitting behind you who have your back. That's right.
It goes back to another trait in my book. The remarkable software companies sell the idea, not the product, which is in this case, that starts with that word, imagine.
Well,
Fascinating how you got that.
do you mind if I say something about that? I love that one. I don't believe software or products is the answer in the future. I actually think, and I actually wrote about this recently on LinkedIn, I believe the software stack is going to start to disappear, and the agentic concepts will take over because software is fundamentally built for humans to be able to interact with it. But agents don't need that layer to be able to produce outcomes and complete jobs. And so I think we'll see a very interesting shift past the concept of legacy SaaS software towards a world that's more kind of virtualized concepts of software with generated experiences that come out of those to make sure that humans can interact with it. But it will be a very different world, which is, I think, fascinating and a fun time to be building.
I've been around long enough to completely agree with that, because this is really about creativity and being able to, like you say, step back and see what else is possible, and being so curious to challenge the status quo, ask those hard questions, and then have be open enough to be willing to see how things could be different. Very interesting. So you then decide to kind of you were talking about timing. You take a technology stack which is agentic, which was likely back then in November 23, early days. So what has been
Yes.
the hardest nut to crack in order to get this going?
Yeah. So first, when we first started telling the story, you're right. It was so early. People would look at us sideways and be like, what do you mean agentic? Like, what's that even mean? What's an agent? How do we apply that? But take that to the side because it's been an incredibly fast kind of learning cycle for pretty much everyone, that we now walk into to lenders and they're there. They understand. They're already in market. They're looking for these types of solutions, which is incredible, speed of change. But there's two things you have to solve to deliver this. If you want to deliver end-to-end job capable agents into an organization, there's two pieces. You need the infrastructure level that lets you generate those agents to do the jobs. So we call that the human agentic infrastructure layer. It's how do you create a system to generate agents? It's better than just custom coding an agent. That doesn't scale, right? We
No.
think in systems levels. That's what real, kind of solutions and entrepreneurs do is how can I build systems? But the second thing is how can I create domain expertise? Because building agents generically doesn't achieve the most critical thing in lending and in really any workflow, which is greater than human level accuracy. So you have two things you have to do side by side. One, build human agentic infrastructure that allows you to launch agents as needed to do different jobs. And two is to build that infrastructure in a way that the agents develop domain experience and expertise. How do you train them, tune them? Get them to achieve greater than human level outcomes through evals and benchmarking and all the other things that you have to do. And so that's where, when you can converge those two things, then you can go in and you can put an agent in place. You can achieve success for your customers. You can show them the outcomes. That's where we've been building.
Yeah, glad you're talking about it that way, because that is actually the hardest nut, or it's not the hard, it's doing the hard things first, building that infrastructure. Has it been a conscious decision from the start? Because at the end, you can also, a lot of people are always like, okay, let's build first a minimum viable product that shows the capability, but the others are going, no, we have to do it the right way, and before we go to market, this needs to be in place. So what was your journey here?
Yeah, myself and my two co-founders, we're all serial entrepreneurs. And we started this company bringing along all the baggage, but also all the learnings of our prior entrepreneurial, endeavors. And we've all been very fortunate. We've had great startups. We worked with incredibly intelligent people. We've produced good outcomes for our investors. But in this one, we did have a set of founding principles. And it's funny, you talk about minimum viable product. We talk about minimum viable integration. And we talk about time to value as being the core
Exactly.
founding principles. How can we get a customer live as quickly as possible and prove that value? This is so different than the traditional SaaS platform implementation. I wrote about this the other day, which is like, if you can get in there and within 30 days show that you can do the job, that's critical. So that's where we started. We said, like, what allows us to do that? And then I'll be very honest with you, the greater than human level accuracy out of the gates, we failed. Like our first attempt, we fell flat on our face and it was embarrassing. And we picked ourselves up and we said, what did we learn from this? How do we focus on that? And so we built a lot of things around improving that. We built kind of our own in-house approaches to getting accuracy up. And then we also did some best practices, some norms, some other things that, people are really pushing the limits right now and building in the open. And so we're able to learn from our peers, which is incredible. And we're also sharing some of our stuff with our peers, and they're learning from us, hopefully. And so we came back and we said, oh, I think we had a breakthrough. And we started to get better and we started to get better. And all of a sudden, we started to achieve that. And that's when we saw adoption start to hit, right? When all of a sudden we could go time to value, less than 30 days, and accuracy above human level, all of a sudden there was product market fit signals.
Let me make a small interruption here. Joshua just revealed something most founders won't admit. Their first attempt at achieving greater than human accuracy completely failed. They fell flat on their face and were embarrassed. But here's what sets his approach apart. Instead of pivoting to something easier or declaring it impossible, They treated failure as data. They picked themselves up, learned what broke, and then kept building until they cracked it. That moment when accuracy finally exceeded human levels is when adoption started to hit. And most founders pivot at the first sign of technical failure. Joshua's team saw that was a price of admission. And this is what makes software companies remarkable. They master the art of curiosity, create something valuable and desirable, and with that, create fans, not just customers. Want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. Exactly. It's funny how this whole AI thing is evolving, because there's been skepticism and like, what is this really all about? And now the bar is, okay, if this thing can do better than human accuracy, then there is value. And that is the thing to prove. It's not about like 10x more. No, it's if it's 10, if it's 20% more, it just needs to be more accurate and needs to be reliable. Fascinating to see that. I read indeed about your minimum viable integration. What I also saw in that same area around differentiation is that you indeed started with like the harder things, like the complex bespoke lending versus maybe standardized loans. Was that a conscious decision?
Yes. It's funny, because of our root, because of being founders and having taken things like venture debt and mezzanine debt and AR lines over the years, that's what we think about when we think about credit. Mm-hmm. I don't think about mortgages. I mean, of course, you know, I have a mortgage. I don't think about auto loans. Like, you know, of course those exist as well. We think about the complexities in getting credit for our businesses to help us do what we want to do. Venture debt is a tool that we use to grow in different ways. And if it takes too long to get venture debt, then that impedes what we need to do as a founder, as an entrepreneur. And so we were like, how can we help with that aspect? And I think one of your kind of key traits is offer something valuable and desirable. Right. Like, So it almost comes down to that, which is, you know, companies tend to solve for the easy things because the easy things they can get their head around. Right. Mortgage lending is more prescriptive. It's easier. It's like, you know, if A equals this, then the loan is issued. But yeah, complex credit and venture debt is not the most complex. We work in many types of complex credit now, but complex credit is bespoke. It's unique. It's got thousands of pieces of data that have to be assessed. It's got unique criteria. It's got literally decisions that are only made for that one loan, for that one borrower. And we said, if we can move the needle there, then we can really start to differentiate. And we think about outcomes. What are the outcomes we want our solution to provide? We call them the three hills. We climb three primary hills: move faster, lend more, and worry less. And so what does that mean? Move faster means make a credit decision in hours versus weeks. Why? Because borrowers want that, because that helps the borrower go out and do what they need to do, right? Lend more means scale your book of business, scale your loan portfolio without hiring more people. Lenders want that because that drives revenue. That's top line. That's growth for them. And worry less means be able to understand all the risks, we call it increasing the aperture of understanding of risk without having to worry about having humans do that. That's about reducing loss. That generates more alpha. Those three things, those are our founding principle outcomes that we drive every decision towards.
I like how you say that, particularly because they're so easy to understand. I can remember them. Everybody can remember them. And in a company, but no matter where you are, in your department, every decision that you make, you can actually hold it against those three principles and say yes or no without going to anyone else.
It's funny you say that, because our internal product prioritization process, we take a Sisyphean approach to it. We say our job is to push rocks up these three hills. Each rock represents a capability that we're moving up the hill. Which hill are you moving? You have to pick the hill, pick the rock, design the rock to get it up the hill as quickly as possible, figure out who the right people are to get it up the hill. It just gives us a structure for knowing how are we delivering value with everything we're doing to the end outcome we're trying to generate.
Yeah, I like it. And at the end, it all sticks to like what customers are prepared to pay a premium for, which is value. Yeah. And it's not this one thing that everybody's saying. You actually added two more that almost feel like they don't go together.
It's funny. It's also about objection handling. When you're
Uh-huh.
selling a product, it's very hard for a lender to say they don't want to achieve one of those three outcomes.
True.
Like, do you want to reduce risk? Yes, I want to reduce risk. That's core principle of lending, right? Do you want to be able to make faster credit decisions so that you can win the best loans? Absolutely, right? Do you want to be able to scale your business? Without a doubt. And so tying it to those three objectives allow us to prove the ROI of the investment as well, right? It's like if I am hiring another person, I can say that that allowed me to scale my book of business by five loans. Well, if I am hiring Enfi to do a job, which is not like you're not buying our software, you're hiring Enfi to do a job, we can prove the value by that outcome that we generate.
Yeah. Funny how this whole thing of jobs to be done is now coming alive through software. So
It's
it's,
amazing how that has come straight back into the front, right? And it's a phenomenal, approach to things. But yeah, it's taken on a whole new life.
Now people can really see that thing. You talked already about this trait number two, remarkable software companies deliver something valuable and desirable, and then you connected that to differentiation, which is trait number three. What I've already started to pick up on is because of the choices that you've made early on, and I mean, just imagine the company is just 18 or 19 months old, that this whole thing of being different, how does it manifest in the day to day?
So we, of course, want to differentiate our product externally, but when you say being different, I want to talk about what we do internally, because that's what really is the driver of success, is how are we a different type of company fundamentally? You say that we've only been around for 18 to 19 months, but we've lived a lifetime
Yeah,
in
I
that
know.
period. And the speed at which things are moving now is incredibly different than it was for my last few startups. So, like, there's kind of a whole shift towards this concept of AI first companies. Like, what does it mean to build a company in an AI first world? Our entire company right now is 14 people. This is something that historically, to get to where we are, we would be a 50 person company, maybe more. But at this point, we're 14 people operating like a 50 person company. I think we can operate like a 150 person company. This is where every day we're challenging ourselves to continue to think of ways to leverage AI and the ability to effectively multiply our capacity to do more. This is how we differentiate. And so we have literally a constant challenge going on internally about what's the next unlock we can figure out about operationalizing ourselves to parallelize ourselves. And this, as a founding principle as well, has been a fun but crazy challenge that we've like embarked on. And so we, like, even myself, like, I'm working harder in this company. I've gotten to a point in my life where I'm very fortunate. I don't need to work this hard, but I have never been this excited about the pace of innovation, about the opportunity that we're sitting in front of. I am working my butt off because it is just a wild time to be building companies, and we can challenge every norm about building companies. We can do every single thing differently, how we market ourselves, how we build our story internally, how we build our teams, how we write code, how we release code into production, how we architect things. So we're building internal agents just as much as we're building external agents. It's just incredibly different in every single fundamental way you can imagine.
Fascinating, fascinating. Yeah, I mean, I wish I would have written my book 5 years later, because then you would have been a case study. So, but maybe for the next one.
Well, you know what's
What?
fascinating? Every company I've built, I would rebuild so differently now if I
Exactly.
had the chance. So I think when you say maybe the next one, it's time for your sequel. Like, what do we know now that we didn't know then? And how has everything changed? That would be a phenomenal follow-up.
Well, I mean, I'm currently starting the second one, so there's room to steer here.
Perfect.
One of the things that I read between the lines when you talk about this is that also the kind of like the fun that you're having that makes you go the extra mile. I mean, it's inspiring how 14 people can actually do a job of a company that would normally be 50 to 100 people. I mean, so often I hear companies say, "Well, we've grown and we are now 120 people." And it's like, okay, what does that say? Good for you. Sorry for you.
I used to say that. I used to say
Yeah,
that about my
yeah.
companies.
So yeah, good for that. I mean, that metric ARR per employee is becoming such an important thing because it says everything about how you create leverage. But one thing I also read is that for you, it's more about building lasting companies. And one of the quotes that I've kind of highlighted here is, "We want to be held accountable to our employees as much as we want to be held accountable to our customers, and as much as we need to be held accountable to our investors." Is that sort of three, the triangle and accountability? Tell me a story about that.
I love that you went to this. So, four companies I've built over the last 25 years now. I've invested in an enormous amount of startups. And the real differentiator is not in the product you build, because products come and go, technology evolves. It's not in the market you choose to compete in. It's in how you choose to build the company itself, the people you choose to work alongside, invest in, fight the fight with. And the culture is everything. And so I've developed a lot of theories over the years, but principle to the culture theory is that culture itself is an organism. It lives, it breathes, and it is impacted positively or negatively by every single thing around it. The environment itself is the impact on the culture. So, how the economy is doing impacts your culture. How, your employees' health is doing impacts the culture. Whether you hire that one person that, lifts everyone up or drags everyone down impacts your culture. Whether or not, you bring lunches in and have a culture where, you promote sharing and you promote risk-taking and failure is equally celebrated as much as success, right? Like each one of these things is an impact to your culture. You can't design a culture. Like I've tried. You can't say, here's what our company will feel like, not look like, but feel like as an employee. It's impossible. But you can feed a culture with all the good things that hopefully help it to evolve like an organism into something that is a great place to work. That's my number one thing that I care about in this world. How do I build companies that are a great place to work, where the culture promotes that, where people want to stay? And the only real measurement of that is by talking to the employees. Like, does it generate that experience that they're looking for? Do they stay? What's your churn rate of employees? We haven't had employees leave us yet, but we're still early, right? Like, so it's hard to say whether we've achieved that here. And honestly, the world has changed so much that the environment for the culture to grow has changed so much that, like, I don't know if we're on the right track yet or not. Like, we're still
No.
evolving. So it's a fascinating thing.
But has that got to do that magic? Has that got to do with accountability? That people feel accountable for what the value the customers are getting?
I hope so, right? Like, I think that is a core principle of the kind of culture we want, which is like every employee feels like A, they own what they're doing, and B, they're accountable for what they're doing, and they have the autonomy to do what they need to do to be successful to that, accountability. Because I think that's the struggle. Like, if you don't feel like you have that autonomy and can do what you need to do, like owning the outcome is not really owning it. And
That's true.
so, yeah, I think that accountability is key to a good culture.
So how are you then? I mean, 14 people is still relatively easy to manage. But at the end, everybody has their own objectives and they are working towards one particular thing and everybody does their own thing. How do you ensure that it's all orchestrated? Everybody, connected to the same outcomes that you have?
So we have a transparency principle as well. And so for us, we share everything. Like as an employee here, you know what the financials of the company are. You know our decisions of when we're going to hire new people, when we're not going to hire people. You know what, customer deployments are going well and which ones we need to work a little harder on. You know where the gaps in the product are and where the product, is being successful. You know everything. We do not hide anything about how the company is performing or what we need to work on. We openly discuss it constantly. We do things called lunch and learns. We do things called beer and demos every Friday, where the whole company comes together and we celebrate the things that we're working on. We also talk about where we're, struggling, the failures. And that transparency is key to everyone aligning. So, like after every board meeting, we share the whole board deck with the entire company because I want everyone to understand what's happening in the boardroom, right? That is a key principle to being able to say, oh, I get it. I see the alignment. I know where we're headed. It's incredibly important that I participate because I'm accountable for that outcome we're working together to deliver.
Do you believe that in 5 years' time, when we do another podcast, and you then, instead of 14, you then 140 people maybe, but actually running a business of 5,000 people, that it will still be as transparent? I mean, how far can you do you think it will take?
I don't know if we'll be 140 people in 5 years. It's certainly we're not designing for that.
Okay.
You mentioned a KPI, a metric that's critical, which is, the revenue per employee metric. And I think, the sign of a really good SaaS company over the years has been measured in, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 per employee. That like you're crushing it if you're at that. I want a multiple of that. I want a factor of that, right? I want 10x that. And I don't want that to be a ceiling, right? I believe we can fundamentally build our platform, our solution, our customer base, our delivery mechanisms to achieve a far greater outcome on that metric alone. That 5 years from now, when we sit down and talk, and I'm going to hold you to this, we're going to do this. I want to talk about what we learned in our journey to that KPI, to how we broke away from the fundamental principles of what SaaS software looks like, because we thought differently. We changed everything to achieve a different outcome.
I love it. Let's have that. I'll put it into my agenda.
Let's do it.
Looking at the time, gosh, I mean, we could talk for hours on this. What has been the most impactful thing that you've uncovered to, well, to grow the company for now? I mean, possibly it's the agentic angle to it, but is there more to it?
The thing that seems to be catching on like wildfire right now that we really are excited about is more about adoption within a customer than signing on new customers. We're seeing incredible opportunity in both, but product market fit is not just about finding new customers, but it's also about finding how your customers use your platform in a meaningful way, who the hero users are, who the people who literally determine that they can't live without it, and then how your platform grows within that enterprise, within that customer. And that's where I'd say the one thing that we've started to uncover is, which is when you can complete a job end to end, in our world, think of it as financial spreading or writing a credit memo or doing an underwriting decision or portfolio monitoring a loan or managing covenant compliance. Those are jobs. And when our agents can prove that they can complete that end-to-end flow, what happens is our customers, people within those customers say, well, hold on, I have another use case. Let's do that. And we start to see this organic growth of new agents, novel use cases spreading across an organization and building where we believe is the outcome, which is we become the AI strategy for these customers. Not, I'm going to go work with 10 different companies to solve 10 different problems. It's, I've found the company that can help me scale my human capacity problem across any job I need to scale it in within credit, within lending, within banking, within private credit. That's who we're becoming. And that realization has started to click for our customers. And that's amazing. That's customer-led growth. I love it.
I love it. Yeah, exactly. That's the way that example as well. Two things on that. First of all, well, you talked about that you start to see new use cases coming from your customers. What What has been the most unexpected way a customer has used the product or thought about the product that made you rethink the potential of it? Has there been an example of that?
Yes, and this is what's awesome. They tell us about use cases we don't think about. And some of those are actually pretty small but impactful. So the other day, we had a customer who they're using us for all kinds of things. They're using us for portfolio monitoring and for underwriting. And they said, "You know what? We have this really annoying thing we have to do, and it's a human problem. We have to take every time we make a credit decision and we issue a credit memo. That's the way that our investment committee, our credit committee, is determining that we're okay with approving the loan. And then we send it to our lawyers, who are most usually an outsourced legal firm. And those lawyers draft what's known as an LSA, a loan and security agreement. It's the legal definition of the credit memo. It's what gets signed by the borrower and is agreement between the borrower and the lender for all the rules that govern that loan. It includes covenants and non-covenant compliance. It includes all the other terms." And they say somebody, a human, has to go through and review the credit policy and the LSA draft and say, does it accurately capture everything? Is every definition correct? Is every calculation in there around financial covenants correct? Are all the reporting dates correct? And you're comparing a 30 or 40 page credit memo to a 100 to 300 page legal agreement. And that takes hours and it's error prone and it's mundane and everyone hates it. And they said, could an agent do that for us? And so we said, well, let's spin one up. 10 minutes later, because we think in systems, we had an agent spun up. The agent did the job. It does it in 10 minutes, and it verified that it does it at higher than human level accuracy. Roll that agent out to a lender, and a lender who has 100 loans that they're issuing a year, that saves them one person equivalent over the course of the year of labor. Literally, an agent that took 10 minutes against a use case that's super narrow that we did not think about, deployed it in 10 minutes, does the job very, very well over and over and over again. And everybody's happy. That's like how our platform uncovers new novel use cases that we don't think about and how it can flex to those use cases and deliver value.
So imagine you got 1,000 or 2,000 lenders that all come with these type of use cases. When do you say yes and when do you say no? Because I mean, it can also blow it up.
Yeah, we don't get in the way of saying yes or no because the way that we think of the system and design the system and built what I call the human infrastructure level, the human agentic infrastructure, the system flexes to a natural language description of what it needs to do. So our customers can describe the problem to the system. That spins up agents. We call it the agent factory, and it spawns agents to do that job. Those agents can select the tools they need. They can build new tools if they need new tools. They can connect through A to A or MCP or APIs to other agents and systems. They have their own way of validating, the outcomes and measuring the quality to make sure they achieve that greater than human level act, outcomes. And those pieces mean we don't care if we don't know how to do that use case today. A human can teach it how to do that, and that human can be any customer. And that's the beauty of system level thinking that scales.
And that's fascinating, exactly. So how has your definition of success changed over the years?
I think I have a grudge that I'm constantly thinking of success as something bigger than what I've done previously. Like I've never achieved the next success that's, bigger. And it's not about money, Tom. It's about how do I really build something that's impactful, that's changed something meaningful? How can we build the largest agentic workforce that solves jobs across all types of credit in all types of credit organizations and lenders and borrowers all get a better outcome? And in the future, they're like, our world is better, right? That's how I want to be leaving a mark. And to be honest, I haven't left one that big yet. And that's the grudge that I hold, and the success I want is to leave that level of a mark.
Will there ever be a moment whereby you say, "Hey, we're done with lenders, we're done with credits, we go to manufacturing companies or whatever the next thing is. Because I mean, technically, you're building a platform that's, yeah, you could learn all other kind of things. So, but how, what makes you stay in the lane of that niche?
First, that niche is trillions of dollars. In the US alone, $112 billion goes towards lending professionals. 2.9 trillion if you look at financial services professionals in the world. So absolutely, we think there's a big place to go after just lending. Given that, there's two sides of this. One is the human infrastructure layer. The other is the better than human level accuracy at doing these jobs. And so that piece, like, that's why you can't take a generic platform and bring it into this world and get the same outcomes. We have to really train it for these roles on these types of documents. This is private, kind of data that nobody else has and can train on. And so building to do well is half the problem. So as we scale beyond that, we have to think about that. Now, we've thought there's use cases everywhere. Of course, there's insurance, right? It's tangentially connected. It's underwriting. It's portfolio monitoring. It's the same fundamental challenges. So there's always that. But think about procurement, right? Think about vendor risk assessments. Think about, like, there are so many ways this can fan out. But for each one of those, that vertical needs some focus and some energy put into it. And that's why we are very focused right now on lending risk intelligence and the jobs that are necessary to do that well.
Exactly. Trait number one, acknowledge that you cannot please everyone. Okay, last question then. If you think about the big lessons that you've learned that have meant something for you in your career, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you would like to share with other entrepreneurs that aspire something similar to you?
Yeah, the best lesson is honestly don't be afraid of failure. Like just put yourself out there, like build in the open, get in front of like whatever you think, you can do, try it out, fail fast and move on, because that failure is the most incredible thing to learn from. And like other people have said that, people way smarter than me say, look, if you're not embarrassed by your first release, you waited too long. I believe in that as a fundamental like truth. Like, put it out there, get feedback, learn, iterate. It will become a better product at the end of the day. You can never guess what it's going to look like. Things to not do, don't slow down. Never get complacent. Somebody is always on your tail. Somebody is always going to out-accelerate you in some way. Do something that you didn't think of. So complacency is death in a startup.
Yeah, we completely agree on that. I mean, the number of times I've written about it in my book is, yeah, I think I've got a half a chapter on that. Complacency, because everybody thinks, okay, well, we've built something so great, we're unbeatable, and still they are.
Nobody's unbeatable.
Yeah, where can people go to find out more about NFI, or to say hi to you?
Ultimately, there's two places. Go to www.enfi.ai, ENFI.ai. You can learn about that there. You can always follow me on LinkedIn. Happy to connect. Always looking to connect with other entrepreneurs and with, people who are doing really interesting things. Of course, people in credit. And if you have questions for me, you can reach out directly. Always happy to engage.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for sharing all the wisdom, the passion, the energy. Because a lot of people that are listening to this will, like, I think, get a lot of inspiration from this to just try a little bit harder. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for having me on today, Tone. It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. And I look forward to our repeat podcast in 5 years, when we come back and we see how each of us have evolved and changed since then.
Okay, thank you. And this wraps up my conversation with Joshua Summers, CEO of NFI. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Tom. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.